Welcome to the Good Listening To podcast with me, Chris Grimes, the podcast series that brings you The Clearing, where all good questions come to be asked and all good stories come to be told. And where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors, a clearing, a tree, a storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, and a cake. So yes, who are you, what's your story, and what life lessons learned along your way would you like to share with us? So welcome to a GLT with me, CG, and we're recording. And, oh yes, now welcome. This is a very privileged, awesome, wonderful day in the sunshine of The Clearing. I'm really excited to talk to Genevieve Grant Thompson, who I have long thought of as being a real wise, wise woman. If you're from Ireland, which you're not, you'd be a banshee in a good way. You're from New York, we get that. Why I'm excited, and just to blow lots of smoke at you, is I've known you for, this will be our 11th year. I met you in 2010 at a really energetic shift moment in my life. And you were a real mentor and continue to be ever since, actually. And I often think about you. And indeed, if I could credit you with one of the most profound lines I still use in my own coaching about energy being, you know, the elixir of all connection. You said once, your energy is like a precious pot of golden honey. Be very, very careful where you pour it. And I've so resonated and chimed and echolocated to that notion ever since. Because I'm like a Duracell bunny in my life, and energy is a wonderful wellspring of geyser. I don't mean me as a geyser, but I'm talking about a geyser of life force. And so it's a really important thing. So welcome to The Clearing on the Good Listening To podcast, Genevieve Grant Thompson.
Yay! Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also, you're my first guest who I'm speaking to from a boat, please. So just tell us where you're speaking from.
I am in a little town called Rickmansworth right now on the Grand Union Canal. Do you know it at all?
I do. Rickmansworth, ironically, was the place of my first ever teaching practice when I was doing a junior school placement. When I was at the Central School of Speech and Drama doing my teaching degree, Rickmansworth was the first year of my four-year degree placement.
Wow. Well, that's where I am. So there's a thing called an aquadrome with beautiful lakes, and we're on the canal. And I'm sitting on my boat with the water on one side and the towpath on the other and floating.
Last time I saw you, actually, which is quite a few years ago now, was on the boat, or one of you've got two boats, haven't you?
We used to. We used to, and then we had one, and now we have two again. So, yeah, we have two, but it's one of them is different to what you know. Yeah.
Okie dokie. So, yes, yeah. Welcome. We're going to take you through the lovely construct of the storytelling metaphors as we go. So the first thing to talk to you about is if somebody does that rather clunky thing and they don't have any reference point as to who we are and they just turn to you and say, what do you do? What's your favourite way of answering that, Genevieve?
Ah, that's funny. I haven't been asked that in such a long time. I guess I haven't been in new environments for very long. What do I do? Right now, my first answer is that I write. I'm a writer. And then they tend to ask what I write. And I usually push the question away and say, whatever I'm curious about right now. And I guess the other thing that I do is I listen. That's my jam. Yeah, I'm a professional listener.
And interestingly, when I Googled you, because I could, before we did this conversation, interestingly, right, as it happens on your LinkedIn profile, it just says writer first and foremost, a personal performance coach. And then you've also said somatic worker, which is an intriguing word.
Yes. So that refers to, I started off as a massage therapist in that field of somatic work, and then began to doing massage since 2001, I think. And so for me, somatic worker means acknowledging that we are inhabiting and inhabited through our bodies and doing work with that. So people come to me for a massage session, but very often what ends up happening is that we work with language as well as touch and movement through whatever their blocks are. And massage therapy just never seemed to really speak to all of that. So these days I can work with people by talking with them about their concerns. Someone might call up and say, hey, I've got this ache over here and I think this is going on. There's a particular kind of conversation you can have about your somatic, your bodily experience and your senses and your kinesthetic sense and how that makes meaning for you in the world and therefore how you can be better in the world and in your body.
And to be explicit then, somatic, I've inferred the meaning of it from what you've just been explaining, but in a nutshell, body. What's somatic? Just means body.
Yeah. Yeah. So the soma is the body. But the word means more than just like, oh, my foot. It means that the thing that I call myself that is material.
Beautifully put. Yes. In fact, interestingly, I was speaking to somebody just yesterday who talked about their chronic pain situation, which is slightly left of field to what I thought we were there talking about. But they talked intriguingly, somatically, about how they have a groin strain, but it affects their jaw. And I was intrigued by that because of the jaw. And I had no idea until I said, tell me a bit more if you want to. And just the idea that parts of our body are surprisingly linked was what I took from that.
Absolutely. There's a really simple trick you can do where if you stick your finger in your mouth, thumb in your mouth and suck on it, you will often feel your pelvic floor move, like lift.
Wow.
Right? So there's a really, I love that game where you just sort of, you got to get relaxed and you got to listen for it, but you will often feel a little tug. There's like the body is just an extraordinary thing. It's such a cool device and machine. And it's also the only way that we know anything is through what we experience.
We have to experience
our body, you know?
People listening, I would encourage you to stick your thumb in your mouth, give it a good suck and see if you feel so that makes such sense to the notion of a baby wanting comfort and then adults subsequently wanting comfort.
Exactly. And it's, you know, and that's all of that discovery came about through the recognition of oxytocin as the sort of drug of love, right? And that was discovered, I forget the name of the woman who figured it out. Of course, it was a woman, and she was into sort of psychoanalysis and neurology, I think. But she discovered that there was this particular chemical that our bodies produce that happens when we feel that particular feeling of love. And I think her research focused predominantly on mothers and babies.
Beautiful.
Right.
Lovely. So
which I have to say makes me think of you because the thing that I... One of the things that I think about when I think of you is how in love you are with your family and your children.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's the thing that I first knew about you that always carried that feeling of like, oh, that tenderness and that. Yeah. So there's oxytocin in the air in your house all the time, I'm sure.
It's nice to be able to name it now. What's that smell? Oh, it's oxytocin. It's good. Lovely. Love that. And 10 years ago, we had sort of working voices in common, which is how I met you. But you were such a profound and immediate sort of wise presence that I remember thinking, you know, in the culture of the company that I strayed into, there was a sort of an idea of a door opening and then immediate inclusivity. And I remember being slightly in awe, if I may, about the fact that, gosh, day one, I'm going to be alongside this person. And it was just a real, you know, he really gave me the nudge of confidence, having had a real, I'd had a real hiccup I was sort of dashed on the rock of something circa 2010. But actually 10 to now has been when I've really, really found my true purpose. But you're at the sort of genesis point of a newfound reinvigoration, which is, you know, again, there's a story behind the story there, which we don't need to go into. But it's just really, really lovely to reconnect with you now and give you the gift of bringing you into the construct of the Good Listening To podcast.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears. Beef and Skittles. Cider with Rosie. Common or garden. Ant and deck. Fish and chips. Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, so you've gone and built this thing for yourself, and now I get to sit in the world that you've built, which is really lovely. And I remember one of my favorite moments of coaching, teaching ever, was when I got to coach you. Because you went, bing!
Gosh, thank you. I find that quite moving. Thank you. That's very generous. So my gift back to you then, shall we say, is to bring you into the Good Listening To podcast structure. So first and foremost, as I do with all my guests, let's talk about a clearing, Genevieve Grant Thompson. Metaphorically or literally, what is a clearing for you?
I think of two things when I think of a clearing in terms of a space to, like, what I crave when I want to make my work in the world. And one is an actual clearing, like walking through just over here, for example. I'm pointing to where the trees are on that side of me. You can walk through the woods and there's lakes, and then you can turn a corner and find a little spot where people are not hanging out, where there's a bit of grass surrounded by trees. And I was thinking about that specifically. And I think for me, in that respect, a physical clearing is actually not so much a clearing, but the spot at the base of a tree. Every now and then you find a tree where you can sit at where the trunk meets the ground and it kind of holds you. Or climbing a tree, you know, like trees that are quite user-friendly. You can climb a tree and you know you could sit in the cradle of a quite a large branch. For me, that's like a everything, every cell in my body just goes, okay. And now I can settle and be calm. And the other thing is my desk, which is just a plank of wood stuck above some bookcases, but it's the site of my promise to myself that I can do deep thinking and good work.
In a clearing is a tree and you and me. I love that. Also, reintroducing myself to you and thinking about the honey line that I've already attributed to you. There was an extraordinary picture, ironically, of a big honey, a bee honeycomb, extraordinary, sumptuous picture of honey attached to a tree. So I love the fact that there, in your clearing is a tree, and also the plank and the wood of your desk. Yeah. Also behind you, there's wood as well. You've got some panelling within your boat. Also, I know because of your wonderful nomadic tendency, I think you said Thursdays is boat moving day. Is that what you said? Because we were talking about when to tick.
Yeah, I don't move every Thursday, but because of the rhythm of the rest of my life, I try to reserve a day when I know I'm going to move a boat. If we were to move the boat, it would be Thursday.
Yes.
Yeah. And you don't do anything else on boat moving day. You don't make any other promises because you never know what's going to happen.
But I love the fact that you're in search or the epic quest to find a new clearing in the next mooring spot.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, when Steve and I, like in normal times when we would move the boat, we'd cruise along and then we'd find a spot and then we'd tie up and settle everything in and then we'd lock the boat up and go for a walk and go exploring. And that's one of the best parts about being nomadic is every new place is like, which bit of this is home for us? Where's the local pub? Where's the local shop? Oh, I like that. Maybe I'll come sit here and read a book, or maybe we can come here for a picnic, or I can do a walk around here again. And so you create a map of Great Britain that is a series of places that you can call home.
And how often do you return? Because I presume because it's a limited infrastructure, you can't be going to brand new places each time, can you?
Maybe we could slowly put around the whole country and take a couple of years doing it because there's so many canals and rivers. But of course, we have our emotional center at London. So technically you're not supposed to return to the same spot for a whole year unless you've gone out to a certain location and then you're coming back again. And if you're coming back, you're allowed to come back as long as you're heading in the opposite direction.
Lovely.
So you could get in two visits a year. We probably have done more than that, but you know, we would be in a place once a season, basically.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. And of itself, the sort of the nomadic freedom of the boat. I used to be intrigued by where you come in from today, then, whenever we met, even in the early days, 10 years ago. So I love the fact that it's obviously a lifestyle where you expanded to two boats, shrunk again, now you're back to two boats. Very nice. So I love the segue of the tree in the clearing is perfect, get you, because I now want to bring a tree into the clearing anyway. So how ahead of the curve were you? And we're going to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. So it can be a tree of your choosing or of your, you know, architecture as you like. So you're going to climb the tree and we're going to let some storytelling apples fall out. And they take the form of the lovely storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, where you've had 5 minutes or as long as you've needed to think about four things that have shaped you, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to, squirrels, as you said yourself when I told you about this, to get your attention. And then one quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't also possibly know about you until you tell us. So over to you. You can go where you like, when you like, and you can clonk apples on my head as you see fit. So off you go.
So I think one of the things that has shaped me has been living on a boat, actually. That's an easy one. Choosing a lifestyle that's nomadic and that's off-grid, that is, what's the word, itinerant, which has so many connotations, and choosing to live outside of so many of the constructs that make us feel normal. If you don't have an address that you can get your post to, especially right now, how do you get deliveries? How does your mom send you a birthday card? If you move through the world without having a land-based address that you always come back to, then how do you have a sense of community or belonging or place or village? And all of the things that, all of the emotional stuff that we attach to being on a grid with an address and a map, even the aspiration to like own a house or a piece of land. So many of these things you become aware of only when you step outside of them, really. And then because now I naturally inhabit this place outside of it, I get to make more conscious choices about what I want to step back into.
Yes.
So I have never had a geographic community except for a very brief period living in Baltimore in the States, but I've hardly ever identified with a particular location or piece of land or even group of people. And living the way that I am supports that and makes it feel more normal. So it's like, yeah, of course, as opposed to me feeling disjointed in how I'm arranged in the world. And being conscious of who I'm going to bother to visit because they don't know where I live anymore. So I've got to make sure I make myself available. Being conscious of who I tell where I live and how much water I use because I take my water with me. I'm not plugged into a system, or how I generate my electricity. That kind of consciousness certainly shaped my sense of, it's probably accelerated my sense of, you know, what's going on the planet climate-wise. And it's refined my sense of power and responsibility. I remember when you and I first met, I was working on this idea for myself. I don't know if I talked about it much, but trying to figure out what power is and how it works. And it kept occurring to me that the more responsibility you take, the more the right kind of power you have. And it seems to me that living on a boat allows me to practice that in immediate ways all the time.
There's such an autonomy in the freedom of deciding, I suppose, the metaphorical gypsy life where you go where the winds take you or where the tides take you or where the waterways allow.
Yeah, absolutely. And freedom is probably my... You know, if you were to ask me what I've been looking for my whole life, it's freedom. It's freedom, and every decision I make is me choosing a different kind of freedom and playing with what that feels like. And if you want me to stop doing something or leave a place or give up on something, just make me feel like you're taking away my freedom and I'm out. You know, so I think you've hit the nail on the head that freedom and autonomy definitely is a big part of that.
And in fact, the very powerful adage, and I don't mind reincorporating it, my energy is like a precious pot of golden honey. I've got to be very careful where I pour it. I remember really profoundly, that was a very profound moment of exit. You were going.
Yes. Yes.
And what's so lovely is I've come to find you again, knowing that you left and knowing how powerful that was.
Right. Yeah. That's a very good point, actually. It's like, and it's very much that feeling of, so what you been up to?
Yeah.
We've been pouring it, right?
And in all your freedom, I also know that you're very profoundly attached to where you're from, because I remember lucky enough to be with you in New York, where you're from, and forgive me if it's somewhere else, but I remember that being, there was a little trip once, and we had some comedy moments of going to deliver for a client where we're like scrabbling around trying to work out what the fuck we're doing, you know, trying to finalize a program, and we're live. Oh, fuckity fuck. It was all really exciting in the back of a New York cab. And it was to do with
we were in a car.
And it was like, but we nailed it. But there was a sense of you pointing out the window going, oh, there was a sense of, oh, this is your patch.
Yes, yes. And that was, and so, yeah, there are particular aspects of New York that do feel like home to me. They don't feel like it anymore. So it's a temporal thing, right? Like, I can point to buildings and neighborhoods and say, I did that there and that means that to me, but it's all historic and New York has changed so much. So that's what I mean. Like I can no longer identify with New York as it is, but I of course have a historical love of it. So I don't know how freedom shows up there, but there's definitely a sense of actually the reason I love the culture that I experienced in New York so much was I felt free.
And it also seems like, you know, you take a sense of who your own community goes with you where you go. So obviously there's you and Steve connected, but it's not like you're completely abandoning and moving on. You're actually, it's a bit like bringing your community to the new community you decide to be in. So there's a piece there because you're bringing yourself as a unit of containment with you. So it's not completely, you know, just utter abandon whenever you go anywhere. So there's real commitment to what you're doing.
It gets imprinted in you, right? And in your cells and in your habits and in your language. And then you, exactly as you say, you take it with you where you go. I know that, for example, I was living in New York and then I moved to Baltimore. And that's another thing that shaped me. I spent about a decade in Baltimore before I came to London. That was a decade between like mid-20s and mid-30s where most of us start to go, I think I know who I am a little bit. Like, this is my thing. This is not my thing. This is how I want my relationships and friendships to go. These are my real interests. Those are not really my interests. That kind of discovery. And there was a real sense of being met.
Yes.
That's what it was. And I'm sure I've explained this before, you know, living in England, coming from the East Coast of the States and having that as having New York and then Baltimore. And even when I went from New York to Baltimore, in Baltimore, New York is north of Baltimore. That's why I'm doing this. But when I went to Baltimore, I was told I was a bit edgy for Baltimore, even though Baltimore is a big, strong city. But I realized my communication style has always been, I grew up in an environment where communication was direct, right on the table, in your face. And there's always an assumption that goes with a language style, right? So the assumption was that I can say what I want because everybody around me can say what they want back. So there's a kind of freedom there, right?
A directness and a pragmatism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it doesn't feel like we're pushing on each other too much because it's the nature of the water that we're all swimming in.
Yes. And there's a steeliness in the capacity to be able to live in cities like New York and now London, even though you're very free within London. But there's definitely a steel of streetwise-ness.
Yeah. And a sort of robustness, right?
Yes.
But then I came to
England. And resilience. Yeah.
Yeah. And resilience.
Yeah.
And you don't feel it until you go somewhere else, right? It's just, It's just how it is. So I come to London, and what I discovered in my first few years, I'm walking around being direct, you know, up front and asking questions out loud. And all around me, people are going like,
awkward,
you know, and kind of going, shh, shh, like easy now. And what I learned was that the freedom that sort of the British culture, maybe in the south of England, I notice it's different as you go north, the way that people allow space for each other here is by not saying things too loudly, is by not saying things out loud, because there's a feeling of, I don't want to impose on you, right? And so for me, I was like, why isn't anybody telling me anything? I don't know what's going on. You know, they're all keeping secrets, but there was very much a sense of, we're going to let you do your thing and have our opinions and tell them to each other, but not you, and give you space to do what you want. And so, yeah, so there's, I mean, you can find freedom anywhere, I guess, but yeah, definitely that, I noticed that. And that was, it was quite, I think that probably shaped me as well, in that I, because I wasn't expecting it, because I didn't come here to settle. I came here to go to school, and then I thought I was going home again. So I was curious about what was going on, but I was there to study. And while I was doing that, I had to work part-time. So I'm learning this as a byproduct, not giving it full attention.
And by the way, I very nearly got back in touch with you recently, but then didn't, because I know that you'd gone home for a very, very profound reason. And I don't know if you're going to talk about this or not, but I'll just mention what it is. But I know it's to do with the recent, you know, very sad death of your father. But that's where you did a return home, didn't you? And I don't know whether you went back to New York or whether it was Baltimore.
That was another weird thing. And that's definitely something that has shaped me. My father, who's from New York, New Jersey, and raised us in New Jersey, has lived for over a decade on his sailboat, and his sailboat was in the Caribbean.
Oh.
So what's funny is here in this, so I'm black and white, right? Racially speaking, in the sort of dumbest terms, black and white. My mom is a white lady with blonde hair and fair skin. My father is a African-American guy with the afro and the dark skin. Here in this country, mixed race, people assume that you're Caribbean. That's the automatic assumption. That's the wind rush that came here. So they look at me and they assume it's probably Caribbean going on. My father is not Caribbean, but my father, since I moved here, lived on his boat with his girlfriend in the Caribbean. They sailed from the East Coast all the way down to the Virgin Islands and lived there.
And had he been in Britain, they'd have done an inverse wind rush.
Exactly. Like, right.
It's called a rush wind if you go the other way.
The rush wind, exactly. Flip it. We're going to take some of your land now. You know, but so I went to the Caribbean, which is not my home at all. Another thing that's foreign, absolutely foreign to me. Everything about it is utterly foreign.
Is that where you went to help him die then? Sorry.
Yes, exactly. So in March, we got the word that he was being sent home to die. And my father's home is on his boat, right? And his boat is not in a marina. It's in a harbor. And so I went to the Virgin Islands, to St. John, to help my father die at home. And so it's one thing, again, house on land, you're plugged into the grid, you've got all the resources, it's time to get a hospital bed in, you move out the furniture, you get a hospital bed. That's interesting enough. That's enough of a journey. Try doing it on a boat. And this isn't a yacht. This is like a 38-foot, I think, sailboat where all the furniture is built in. There's no room for a hospital bed. And so I was there for about 2 months, living in a place where it's like 35 degrees all the time, humid, you know, hurricanes. It's like this weird paradise, but I'm there for this weird grieving process. And you don't have cold weather, but you have hurricanes. It's a trade-off, you know. And then my father wasn't dying as fast as we all thought he would, including him. And so I came home to England, to my boat and my husband. And then Well, honestly, it really was a bit of a, I mean, I know everyone's had a rough year. I was going to say I came home to my boat, my husband, and our cat. And then my cat died.
Oh.
Pussy cat. I know.
I know. And what was your pussy cat's name?
Charlotte.
Of course. Oh, Charlotte. Charlotte the Moggy is no
exactly.
more. I'm sorry.
and then about, so that was June. And then September, it was like, yeah, no, Papa really is dying. And his partner, Sandra, she needs help. And my agenda, my commitment was to help her. Was to be a part of that process and to be in it as much as I could. So I got back on a plane right around the time we went into our second lockdown. I got back on a plane again to St. John. And it was wild because the people in the Caribbean figured I was the son of a Caribbean man or person who had gone off and was coming home. So they thought I was doing some kind of homecoming, even though I wasn't local. They thought I was somehow. And everybody thought I was from somewhere where I wasn't.
Yes.
Like nobody but me and my immediate family knew that, you know, that none
Were there other siblings wrapped around you in this quest to help your father as exit?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my brother, who lives on the East Coast in the States, in New Jersey, I think he had like a 4-hour flight to get back and forth. We all had to deal with COVID protections. We all had to be very careful about when it was worth flying and how to fly safely. So he could come and go more easily. So he would come for a bit and help, and then he would go home and he has a wife and a kid. So he could jump back and forth. And my father's partner's daughter, Kara, came to support as well.
Did you all manage to configure in the right place at the right time for what you were there to do?
I think, well, we did. And, you know, we did and we didn't. What was amazing was how all five of us ended up on a tiny little sailboat and managed to find space and make it work. And there was something really beautiful in how everybody found their skills, right? So Kara was always very good at noticing when we needed to eat and like the comforts of like, go get groceries and cook us some food and just make sure that people have
the basics,
you know, clean sheets on the beds. And just she had an eye for that when the rest of us were going like this. My brother is an artist and a carpenter, and he took over the task of building my father's coffin.
Wow. Your father was very aware during all of this as well.
He was aware. Able-bodied. He was slowly getting weaker.
Yeah.
And eventually he had a hard time finding words, but he was fully cognizant, alive, able-bodied most of the time. It was almost more difficult because I realize now it's that old, you don't know what you got till it's gone, right? All of my father's power, well, maybe 80% of my father's power in the world was down to the fact that he could do it himself.
Oh, yes.
And in the last year of his life, he lost, and actually for years he'd been getting older and weaker, you know. And when I would come visit, he would hide things from me. Like there was a time when he had joint pain and he couldn't handle ropes very well, which on a sailboat, you need to be able to handle ropes. So he had made a secret plan with his partner. He would just say, can you get that for me? And she wouldn't argue with him because he didn't want me to know that he couldn't handle the ropes because his hands were hurting. And then finally he got busted. I found out and used my somatic knowledge to help him fix his hands, and then he could handle ropes again.
Oh,
but
lovely. So you found your part, obviously what you could do to lean in to help too was obvious in you being there, but also that's so lovely you brought some of the somatic stuff as well.
Exactly. And yeah, and I showed up and became a central part of his palliative care team. So it was me, his partner, and him. And my brother showed up and did what he could, but he was more about helping in the outside space. And Kara helped, but she wasn't there that long. So I was his death nurse, basically.
And it sounds, if I may, reading between all those really profound lines, that you know that adage of you enabled a good death by the sound of it.
Yeah. There was a lot of talk of like death doula-ing and things like that. And that's what I wanted. I wanted him to die as well as he possibly could. Luckily, that was also his agenda. So we were on the same team, you know. And it was in some ways it was really easy to do because his spirit was so intact, and we were allowed to be sad together, and there wasn't a lot to be afraid of. Like he kept us from being afraid of his death because he wasn't afraid of dying,
which was amazing. Did you have that oxygenation of saying and doing everything you wanted to do, so you felt that you were all at peace with the tragedy, but at peace with it because it's the natural order of things? And
I can go one better than that, Chris. That oxygenation has been a part of my entire life with my father. He never had a bucket list because he always did it, which is extraordinary. You know,
so he lived a good life and a happy life and a fulfilled life then.
Yeah. And I think part of the gift was that, you know, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, slow growing prostate cancer, I think around 2003, and chose his route of living and healing his body as best he could. And that probably put the final, I'll say, nail in the coffin in terms of the death of his ever trying to assimilate into normal society, right? So his whole life, he was like, I'm doing it my way. I'm responsible for my joy. I'm responsible for my well-being. I'm responsible for what my life looks like. And then when he was introduced this, like, we all know we're going to die, but you probably know what you're going to die from. And your timeline has probably been foreshortened. He was like, oh, hell no. Okay, good. Now, any of those little extra things that were maybe a little bit of a waste of time, a bit like my golden honey, right? He was like, no one else gets this but who I really love. And so it just refined it even further. But it wasn't like there was a big flip. He'd always been going that way in my estimation of him. You know, of course, he's my father and I adore him, so I'm going to create a myth out of him. But it's a great myth. And so there was nothing for me to forgive or negotiate. We did that as it came. Fought like cats and dogs when I was younger, you know, and got it done at the time.
And there's a lovely...
I'm not sure that's the case for everyone else, but...
We're going to come on to a cherry on the... We're going to come on to a cherry on the cake later, but the cherry on the cake of the story about your father is the sort of somatic resonance with your capability in what you do, and you're able to bring that to great nurture at his end, which is a really wonderful thing.
I mean, it's extraordinary how well trained I was to do that task. And there were moments when he would be in his hospital bed, and he'd kind of wake up from sleeping, which he did a lot, and look around like he was confused, and I would say to him, you know, what's going on? And he would say things like, well, I think I'm uncomfortable, but I'm not sure. Which is, he was on morphine for the pain, but the morphine didn't knock him out.
Yeah.
And he was having sensations he'd never had before. And he was always very curious about even his suffering. Like, what is this thing? What is it doing? Do I need to change it? Or what can I learn? He was doing that. But because of my training, I could help him get a vocabulary a lot faster. And I could see, for example, I could see the arrangement of his body in the bed and predict where the discomfort was.
Okay.
And so I could simply shift him a bit. And he was always so impressed. I would shift him a bit. I would say, can I move you? I think I might be able to make you more comfortable. And because he trusted me, he would go, okay, yeah, give it a try. And I'd move his leg or his knee or something. And he would go, oh, that's so cool. How do you know that?
So there's a nice combo there of being like a shamanic and a somatic nurse.
Yeah.
Able to be there in the Caribbean when the time was right.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And so using the sailboat analogy that keeps on giving, thank you for telling us that lovely story about your father. I'm going to sail us back to the clearing now, back to the apples that we're talking about. And so far, we've had your boat and your father as being things that have shaped you. Anything else that you want to go back into the tree to shake out for us?
I think having that almost decade of life in like after New York into Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So living in the city of Baltimore, it's amazing how much that place imprinted on me. And I think it's because, so life in Baltimore, shout out to anyone who's ever been in Baltimore. It's a city that had an extraordinary mix of poverty and wealth, fluidity between very separated neighborhoods in terms of poverty, wealth, race. It's a very gay city. It's a very camp city. It's like you can be, before we had all this gender fluid language, everyone in Baltimore had that language because we were living it and around it. And it was just normalized. Camp is what we had for breakfast and the ability to laugh at ourselves. And so to live in that space and to simply witness every day, different people, very different people, living their lives and figuring themselves out. And it wasn't an expensive city. So you could live a life where you could work a part-time job and pay your rent and have enough energy left to make your art.
Lovely. And I'm assuming there's a parallel with Baltimore and San Francisco. This is quite a stereotypical view of cities I perceive as being very sort of gay aware. So I'm assuming that Baltimore and San Francisco, are they in parallel, like almost sisters to each other?
I've never lived in San Francisco, but the reputation that San Francisco has for being like a place where gay people can be safe and happy and out, Baltimore has that too. But Baltimore is a black city. Mm-hmm. Baltimore has a lot more. San Francisco has black people in it. But Baltimore because it's East Coast, it's like right on the border between the North and the South and the Civil War culture and all that kind of thing. So the fact that you had black people owning their property and owning their lives and running things since the 1800s is quite unusual. And that was a big part of it too.
And there's something rich and profound about your ability to be able to, as you've talked about being black and white, if you like, almost binary, light and shade, how you can fit in. Because presumably it's a bit like, if you've got where the rain stops and it's not raining, light, dark, shade, you can presumably step either into either of those domains, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny. I call it unconscious passing, right?
Love that. Unconscious passing from one domain to the other.
I'm sure there's lots of times when I've had an easier way of moving through a space because of my look and I had no awareness of it. I mean, this is how I understand what people talk about as white privilege now, right? You have a way of moving through a space. I'll give you a really simple example. My first year in London, I was in school and I was studying and a lot of my classmates were Greek. And, your first few weeks, you don't know anybody and you're trying to figure out how to make friends while you're studying. And I went to this reading. Harold Pinter was doing a reading, which was just like, he's one of my heroes, right? And I'm like, he's alive and he's reading. I'm there. So I'm in the queue outside to go in. And someone I had seen around or met at some dinner or something or in a pub was ahead of me. I didn't know him, but I knew who he was. So
Are we in London or Baltimore in this anecdote of Pinter?
This is London, but this is just an example of that unconscious passing, right?
Yeah.
So I reach over and I tap him on the shoulder thinking, I've got to be social. I've got to, just say hi to people that you've seen before instead of hiding. So I tap him on the shoulder and he turns around. He looks at me, goes, oh, hello, kisses me on both cheeks and introduces me to his friends. He's remembered my name, kisses on both cheeks. I'm like, oh, I'm in, right? And all these people sort of absorb me into there. They've got a little group of wonderful, philosophical, active artist people, and they just absorb me in and invite me to whatever they're doing, talk to me like they're interested. About 6 months later, I'm sitting around with these people in a pub in South London, and I realize from their conversation with me that they're assuming that I am Greek like them.
Wow.
The whole time, all that treatment, all that openness was because they thought I was a Greek person in London.
And that's a beautiful testament to one's capability to chameleon-like fit in when required. A bit like just change, not changing your spots or being inauthentic, but you've just, you know, if you turn up to tap somebody on the shoulder, when you turn round, there's that immediacy of, is she like me? Can I, you know, humanity is what binds us all. There's obviously something that you're just, there's an immediacy of presentation of self, of my presence is here. Da-da, I can work with that. Kiss on both cheeks. Boom, you're in, which is a testament to connection, actually.
Exactly. And they had assumed, I had no idea that they had assumed I was Greek for months.
You don't even like tiramisulada. I'm kidding.
And by the time I clarified, I was like, no, wait, I'm not, as far as I know, there's no Greek anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Then they already liked me too much. So I was still in, you know what I mean? But I think, so Baltimore had a lot of that going on, I think. You know, Baltimore's got loads of its own problems, but there's a sense of, if you put on the right outfit, you can hang out in any space.
Yes.
You know?
So it's about adaptability as well. Yeah. Adaptability, the ability to blend in.
Yeah. And most importantly, I think, this yes, here's the thing you'll like, this yes and attitude.
I'm all over that.
All over Baltimore. You show up, you stick a flower up your nose and you go, this is my look. They go, yes, and... What
here's
else,
a shrub
you know,
for you. Here's a shrub for your ear.
Up your bum. Wait, exactly. Yeah.
I was quite proud of myself. Know. I didn't say shrub up your bum. That's what I was thinking, but I didn't say it. So
sorry.
I was quite proud.
I
yes, and it's now up my bum. That's lovely.
And I think that goes hand in hand with being able to laugh at yourself, you know.
Yes, have a sense of humor and humility.
Yeah. Humility, yeah. Such a powerful thing. So,
I love the idea of global head of oneself. You know, I'm global head of myself. I can go where I like, when I like, and I can find a way to connect. And you know, I enjoy connecting with people, irrespective of who, the what, the where, the why, the who, the why, the. And it's just interesting to see if you can find a way in, which is partly what this is about. I just love listening to people, which is why I've got really passionate about. Hey, I'll give this person a damn good listening to. What are they going to tell me?
Exactly. Yeah, it's so much fun. And yeah, so I think, yeah, so definitely being in a city that allowed you to sort of try out all the different versions of yourself and just gleefully welcome them all in, you know, that definitely shaped me. So yeah, so what do we got? We've got boat life, my time with my father, Baltimore, being married.
Next, I don't mean next marriage. I mean next bit of information. Next apple.
Yeah, next apple. Boom, being married. Probably a lot because I was never one of those girls who was like, one day I'll get married, I'll find my Prince Charming, and then we'll make a little house and a family and everything will be okay. I never had that image for myself. So I have friends who are still kind of impressed that I'm actually married. And I always say that Steve is the only person I could have married.
Ah, that's lovely. You found the soulmate, the only one that could or should or would.
Like, he's the only one for whom marriage was the right thing to do. Like, if it wasn't for Steve, I wouldn't be married.
And do you mind me asking, had you had previous offers?
I'd had previous...
I mean, proposals. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I'd had previous relationships where people had said, you know, one day when I ask you to marry me.
Yes.
But what's funny is those people, I knew that I would never have married them. So they were on something. I kept shtum about it, not because of their egos, but, you know. But yeah, Steve, I I've had previous, you know, people who I loved deeply and dearly in lots of ways, but was never going to set up house with any of them, was never going to commit in that way. And when Steve asked me to marry him, I, you know, it was this extraordinary proposal, but I remember these two thoughts in my head. One was like, wow, this is a big moment. This is a theatrical moment. Genevieve, you should take it all in and feel it. And I, you know, am I going to cry? This is really profound. And all I could think the whole time I was trying to process it and take it all in was, that could be a lot of fun. That was the only thought.
So there was a lovely joy and spontaneity attached to the connection, which I gathered outside looking in is part of your connection, is the joy of connection and exploration, because he's obviously sharing the life on the boats with you. And you've made me think about that. I don't know if it's an insect at this point, but the water boatman, this creature that's able to sort of go across the viscosity of water and cover a big, big scape of water by just running along the top. So you get to walk on water in the right relationship.
That's really good. We get to, and playfulness is, I had a friend a few years ago who's also married. She asked me what I thought was the sort of thing on which my marriage hinged, like what was the relationship based on. And I thought about it and I was like, yeah, it's playfulness. Like when it's going well, we are children together. Skipping through the world.
Your inner child. I love that, because I'm all about that too. We must never lose our inner child. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have to be a child. You have to be a child to live on a boat with someone else.
And in fact, during lockdown, you know, my family are awesome, but Stan has been my lockdown bestie, my 13-year-old pet Gibbon, as I call him. So, but he's my lockdown bestie, because we're just completely stupid all the time. In a good way.
Yeah.
So you're back to your apples. We're nearly there with Shaking Thee, What Shaped You. This is lovely, by the way. And it all connects, because we're talking about alchemy and gold later, but you're giving me that in spades anyway. Anything else that you'd like to talk about shaping you before we go on to inspire? And again, if there's overlap, it doesn't matter.
Theatre. So my experience with theater is, I think, a little bit different to yours, in that for me, theater has always been a space. I came to it through the desire to help a friend succeed at an audition. I was immediately introduced to political theater, ensemble political theater. So it became, how do we do what we can to make the world a little bit better and put the right ideas into the world? And then I stayed with it because the way that I do theater is I sit out of the spotlight myself and get to listen to the creative minds doing their work. I get to be a handmaiden to these great works as a stage manager, actor, or a dramaturg or a researcher. And when I make my own work, as a writer, I realize I've gone back to thinking like a theater maker. Like I'm creating performative moments. I'm creating these rituals of discovery. And there's something really profound about the idea of committing to make-believe, not just because you're on a stage, but in any moment you can turn something into a profound event or a gleeful event because of how you decide to play it.
Like the magic.
And so theater is,
like the magic if anything's possible.
Yes.
And very sadly, we're out of time for this week's episode of The Good Listening To Show, Stories of Distinction and Genius, with the wonderful somatic worker Genevieve Grant Thompson. If you go along to Buzzsprout, you can listen to the full episode where the podcast is hosted now. It'll also be available very shortly in full-length version on the UK Health Radio podcast too. So thank you to the awesome Genevieve Grant Thompson, who's been a coach to me over the years. And tune in next week for more stories from the clearing. And goodbye.
You've been listening to The Good Listening To Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from the clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@ThatChrisGrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.